Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Molasses Manifesto.
Came home from work tired and without much money, and it built up because the first crime wasn't the first time I was out in the street, you see. I was out. I guess I knew what my intentions were. I don't know why, you know. I look back and see how silly, I don't want to use that word. I look back and see how nonsensical the whole thing was, how senseless, pointless. But I was so angry, I just didn't care anymore. I just walked up to this one car in the first shooting, I just started shooting the gun.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 10, Taxi Driver. Act 1, Travis Bickle. In early July 1976, having just returned from Texas with the 44, David Berkowitz immediately set about emulating his newfound hero, Travis Bickle. Central character and homicidal cab driver portrayed by Robert De Niro in Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. David was less than a month out from committing his first murder.
Just after I got back to New York from Texas, I went back to work as a security guard, and I only stayed there 2 more weeks. It was then I put in the application to get a cab driver's job. I said, the cab drivers make more money. And this guy who worked as a guard used to rides as his own gypsy cab, you know? And he says, yeah, you ought to get a cab. I said, a taxi, huh? So I went to a place in my neighborhood and said, I'd like to drive a cab. Yeah, all right.
In a scene that could have been pulled directly from the movie, David Berkowitz was hired on the spot. Life was imitating art.
Guy, look at me. I'd like to drive a cab. All right, we pay 40% of the profits. You take this form, fill it out. You didn't even look at me. Fill out the form. All right, here's the key. You're number 73. And that was the number I had to call in. This is 73, picking up a passenger. This was a private cab service, you know. And that was it.
David Berkowitz was now a taxi driver, bringing him just one step closer to becoming a real-life Travis Bickle. And he had the gun.
Now I had the guns. I had all the anger and frustration built up. Now I had the cab. And I was actually patterning my life after the movie Taxi Driver.
Robert De Niro's hero.
Right. Not only that, but they have a movie theater in New Rochelle. It's a nice area. And there's a movie theater on Main Street. For 2 days in a row, I saw the movie Taxi Driver after I got back to New York. So within a few months' time, I had seen the movie The Taxi Driver 3 times, you see. Well, when it got to a point that I saw myself, I don't know if you saw the movie Taxi Driver, you say you did, yeah. I saw myself exactly as Robert De Niro, an outcast, a loser, living in a cramped little apartment, which is just everything that was me in that movie, you understand?
And you have been stockpiling weapons and knives.
Yeah, just like that. Even before I saw the movie, you see what's happening. I had his anger and frustration as he portrayed it on the television set. I already had all the weapons, you see, except for the gun which I bought the day after, and now I had the pistol complete to 44, you see. The 44 Magnum they sold there too, but I didn't have the money. And it was too big. I needed a gun that I could conceal, because I guess already I was thinking, well, here we go, you know, this is it. And within 2 months after I got back, less than 2 months, there was the first shooting.
The fact that David had begun stockpiling weapons before seeing Taxi Driver, he saw as an unequivocal sign from the universe that it was all meant to be. This was his path. This was his destiny.
Upon returning to New York, he watched the movie Taxi Driver, and each time he saw it, he got the message that, yes, this movie was made about me. An unhappy person who strategized doing a horrible act and wound up inadvertently becoming a hero, which is what Berkowitz wanted all his life. I think it was that hero connection that he magically thought he could maybe do the same thing. By murdering innocent women, somehow this would turn out to be a really noble thing. It clicked all the boxes. I mean, this is me. I'm a loner. I'm angry. I've got weapons, and now I have not just long guns and ammo, I have a handgun, so I'm all set.
David could feel it in his bones. It had all come down to this. The murders about to commence, David did what any level-headed homicidal maniac would do. He took a leisurely drive upstate to test fire the gun. There in the Catskills, amongst the beautiful scenery that had given David his only glimpse of peace as a boy, he squeezed off a few rounds.
He was sort of solidifying his character in his own mind and seeing more and more parallels between himself and the Robert De Niro character. Went up to practice firing off a few rounds with this newly acquired 44 caliber handgun. Got a job as a taxi driver and began deciding how he was going to go about finding people to kill.
Well, let me add, too, that with regards to the 44, I'd already taken that upstate to fire with a few weeks after I bought it. I drove up to the Catskills, where I used to climb mountains by New Paltz, New York. I don't know if you know where that is, New Paltz. And I went out to the woods there. I knew they have these fields way out there. I just took the gun, fired off about 10 rounds until I got the hang of it, you know, until I just made sure it worked and stuff. And this all happened within a two-month time span between the getting of the movie, the gun, watching movies again, becoming a cab driver, the first crime, you know, taking the gun out to test fire before that first crime. And after that, it was just a continuous succession, a whole lifetime of angers and frustrations coming out.
A month after returning from Texas with the gun, he had actually become a taxi driver. He continued to dwell upon and contemplate the rage that he'd felt since childhood, and within a month went looking for victims and committed the first murder.
The first shooting was in the Bronx. About five blocks from where I worked as a cab driver, where the main office was, you see. I had to go to that main office every morning and to take the cab out and, of course, bring it in, you see. So I was five blocks. I always stayed in that neighborhood five blocks from the shooting scene, you see. But this time I already had the 44. I was already a cab driver. I already saw the movie three times. And within that 2 month span, already the shootings started to take place.
David Berkowitz had become a real-life version of Travis Bickle. Act 2, Crossing the Line. While not quite being a rocket scientist, David Berkowitz is no dummy either. He knows why people want to talk to him. He knows it is because he is a cold-blooded killer, not a poet or a philosopher or a politician. David Berkowitz is a ruthless murderer. But because of his crimes, people have a tendency to bend an ear in his general direction, just as we are doing now. So he attempts, when afforded the opportunity, to use that attention to get what he can from it, without, if possible, giving the listener what he believes it is that they want. And what he believes they want are the details surrounding the string of senseless murders he perpetrated. This he will not do. These he must hold back. in order to successfully play the hand he feels is in front of him. But it's Jack's job as a journalist to collect from David exactly the details he's attempting to gloss over, to deliver these details to the public so they can make informed decisions. That's what journalists do. David doesn't want to see this happen. Ever the control freak and narcissist, David wants to dictate the narrative.
David Berkowitz had made clear when we started the interviews that he did not want, and in all likelihood would not, relive the murders that he committed.
And so, the dance between Jack and David commences. Now, in order for this to make sense, it's important to remember why Berkowitz reached out to Jack for this interview in the first place. In short, David was looking for his taxi driver ending. David Berkowitz wanted to be thought of as a social justice warrior, more specifically, as a victims advocate, specifically for the victims in the 1971 Attica prison riot, and more generally, as a public supporter of the recently adopted quote-unquote Son of Sam law, a law forbidding criminals to benefit financially from their crimes, a law that was written against him. David Berkowitz wanted to have it both ways, to somehow commit these murders, cause an untold amount of pain and sadness to countless people, and then, at the same time, magically come out gleaming on the other side, a champion for the people. This, not surprisingly, was a role most folks were decidedly unwilling to give him. Nonetheless, it was to this end that David had reached out to Jack to get a little help promoting his new image, which, in his mind, didn't have anything to do with murder. But Jack knew that, of course, murder was exactly what they were there to discuss. I mean, there's literally no other reason to talk to David Berkowitz but murder. So with all these factors in play, Jack begins his approach with a steady and experienced hand.
At some point during these interviews, I'd like to talk about whatever you feel comfortable about talking about as regards the immediate events surrounding each crime.
Immediate events? Well, all right.
Okay, let's take the first one.
Well, I'm not going to just go into detail about the crimes themselves. There's no need
okay.
to.
I mean, I'm talking about the mental state leading up to the crimes. How you finally got yourself psyched up enough to actually take the gun and go out for the first time.
Well, that's all difficult to. Say, I don't know where to begin. I can't do that, Dad.
Okay.
Part of the reason David didn't want to talk about the murders was that they didn't jive with his new image. But there was another aspect as to why he didn't want to discuss them, and that aspect was actually fairly legitimate. 2 years prior, during the initial coverage of the crimes, before Jack and David ever met, David had seen firsthand the gruesome and salacious way the media had dealt with the murders. And Jack, even though hand-selected by Berkowitz, was, after all, the media. So, like most things David Berkowitz did, he was fearful and conflicted that, by speaking to Jack, whom he himself had contacted, that something akin to the initial coverage would happen again.
I have to be cautious when you go into these deep subjects like about the shooting scenes before and after, because you know I keep reminding myself I'm dealing with the news media, not a doctor. And
right.
I'm sort of, I have like a complex now after what I went through in New York City with all these news media people callously asking me these questions and then writing it really, you know, it just had a degree of callousness, you know, insensitivity. There's really morbid, the way they worded it was like so morbid and sick, you know. They themselves should have been put in a hospital, you know.
Well, they
couldn't believe, you know, that, you know.
Always the victim, David suggests, Ney states that the initial coverage of his crimes had been so gruesome that he himself had suffered abuse from the press, and due to that, had developed a quote-unquote complex with which he was now dealing. Whether it was true or not that there was a legitimate issue concerning how the crimes had initially been covered, I imagine that we can all agree that regardless, David Berkowitz is exactly the wrong person to deliver this message. Still, he had an agenda to see to.
His main objective was to be known for doing something good by supporting the Son of Sam crime victim law. And he knew what the media was capable of, having seen those murders portrayed in gruesome detail in tabloids in New York City and a couple of books that had already come out, and knew what Hollywood could do that could only, in his mind, encourage more murders in the way that his viewing of the taxi driver had encouraged him to go ahead and take that step and kill.
Jack was no salacious newsman, and Berkowitz knew that. That's why Berkowitz wrote him in the first place. Jack was and is an incredibly empathetic person who spent decades interviewing the truly guilty, so that someday society could learn something, anything, that could potentially help stave off similar future events. That commitment did not include allowing David Berkowitz to whitewash his past. David was and is a murderer. And without revisiting the violent acts that robbed so many families of their loved ones, forever changing their lives for the worse, there is literally no accurate context for this or any discussion involving David.
I had an ethical obligation to continue working on him, to mention that and be as specific as he possibly could be, because we were looking for reasons to try to make something totally nonsensical make some kind of sense in a way that we might be able to foresee it in others who might be out there on their way to becoming the next serial killer.
And so, Jack presses on.
I can try to be more sensitive and careful. See, it's important just before...
As I said, there was no one incident like before each crime that triggered anything. You know, it was just a buildup because the days before, let's say the first crime, I was out driving around, you know, and did with regards to the victims, there's nothing that they did, you see, except with the exception of being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
By the way, it's important to note here that when David says, quote, crime, he's talking about murder. The word crime seems to be his preferred way to refer to violently taking someone's life, no doubt due to the emotional distance it provides. David has a fundamental desire not to get too personal. He wants to stay big and he wants to stay broad, where it's generally safe. That's the way he does things.
I can't say there was any one thing. It was a gradual buildup, and the next thing you know, I guess made a decision to myself almost unconsciously to just begin prowling around looking for somebody to harm.
Quote, I had no plans for attack, so to speak. However, I did have a general idea of where I would be going in search of victims, so I familiarized myself with the streets and possible escape routes from those central areas. Also, I managed to learn all the streets by repeat trips into the areas. I mean that there were nights in which I traveled all through a certain area, but it turned unproductive. I got to know the streets by this method too. End quote. David Berkowitz was not yet a murderer at this point, but that was not for a lack of trying. Just 7 months before, he had attacked a 15-year-old girl, stabbing her 6 times in an attempt to take her life, but had failed, not only in terms of taking her life, but in the sense that it was not a release. It did not feel good to him. She had screamed in his face, and she had scared him. She had made him uncomfortable, and he had seen the terror in her eyes. He did not like that. The whole encounter was far too close, too emotional, too confrontational, and too messy. But that had been with a knife. Now he had the 44, and he knew he could kill, and he knew he could do it from a distance. All he needed was a victim, so he was actively seeking one out. Jack probes David as to his thoughts at the time directly preceding the first murder.
Before you started with the gun, were the deaths of your grandfather and your mother on your mind a lot?
Yeah, definitely. They always are. They always are.
Here Jack is referencing the death of David's adoptive mother, Pearl, in 1967, when David was 14. A death David felt responsible for, due to exacerbating the conditions that brought her cancer back. Jack's also referring to the death of Pearl's father when David was 5, an event that had a profound effect on both David and Pearl alike. Of course, David's biological mother, Betty Falco, was on his mind as well, but we'll return to that in a bit. Jack questions David about his quote-unquote crimes.
Is there any one crime that stands out more than others?
The first, I said. The first.
I suppose that's because of all the stuff you had to go through to psych yourself up.
Yeah.
Didn't you say that it got harder rather than easier to commit the crimes up?
Mm-hmm. After a while, the first one was hard because it was the first one, and I was conscious of the fact that I was stepping over the ground, you know, that invisible line, that finally doing the act that I had been, you know, wanting to do, not, you know, for so long, but I finally need to do it, you know.
David Berkowitz was about to step over the line, a line he knew he could never uncross. It was a guaranteed one-way trip, and Berkowitz knew it. It wouldn't quite be the one-way trip Whitman experienced after perpetrating his murders at the Texas Tower at the University of Austin in 1961, but it was a door into another room, a room from which David knew he would never return. David Berkowitz had decided to take someone's life.
I asked him, what's the difference between crossing the line and not crossing the line? And I think his answer was something like, the difference is you decide to cross the line. You know the line's there and you cross it anyway.
What was that invisible line like to you, so where that line might lie?
It's, well, I don't know where it lies, but, you know, the line is, it lies by just thinking about it and finally doing it, you know. Somebody cuts somebody off on the road, maybe you say, geez, you know, guy should be shot. But then it's another thing to actually drive your car alongside him and stick out a gun and open fire. You understand what I'm saying? The line is just between thinking about it and doing it, actually physically doing it. But to cross the line, it is, to me, it was frightening, you know. I felt, I guess the feeling of power, you know, it was frightening. I didn't enjoy it. I just needed to do it, you know what I'm saying?
It is my belief that harming someone had been in David Berkowitz's mind in one way or another, directly or indirectly, his entire life. And now he had built up enough excuses and collected enough toxic role models to finally go through with it. He was standing with his feet lined up at the edge, and all he had to do was step over. It was Jack's job to document that voyage, and here, in this moment, was his opportunity to catch it and preserve it for posterity's sake, or let it slip through his fingers.
After a number of sessions together, I convinced him that we had to talk about it because that's why I was there in the first place, to discover motives. Why does anyone kill innocent human beings? And he reluctantly agreed to sketch out the details. We had developed a bit of a, you know, he looked forward to my visits. I was good company, and I came and I went, and he didn't have to feel awkward around me And that took work to get him to that point.
And so David opens up.
Came home from work tired and without much money. And it built up because the first crime wasn't the first time I was out in the street, you see. I was out. I guess I knew what my intentions were. I don't know why, you know. I look back and see how silly. I mean, you know, and I don't want to use that word. I look back and see how nonsensical the whole thing was. How senseless, pointless. But I was so angry, I just didn't care anymore. I just walked up to this one car in the first shooting, you know, and I just started shooting the gun.
Nothing about the people in that car that made you say, this is the car that I want to go up to?
Well, there were two women sitting in the car.
What time of day was it when they first shooting?
A little after 1 o'clock in the morning.
And how long have you been out with the gun?
Since about 10 in the evening.
Were you out to the taxi or were you private?
My private car.
And did you know when you started out that, hey, I'm going to go looking for somebody to shoot?
Yes. I was not so cold-blooded about that. I look back at it now, and you know, I can't believe it, you know, that I had reached that stage in life where I just didn't care anymore. I had so much hatred and anger in me.
On a good night, David Berkowitz came home, took a shower, made himself some dinner, then threw on a Peter, Paul, and Mary record, or maybe James Taylor or Carole King. On a bad night, nothing would soothe him, not even Carole. And he would lay awake in an agitated state, unable to sleep. It was on one such night, July 6th, 1976, when unable to take it anymore, David Berkowitz got up, slipped on a blue and white sports shirt and jeans, grabbed the .44, put it in a paper bag, and headed out into the hot, humid night. He drove south from Yonkers on Greenvale, then Nepperhan Avenue, until he arrived at the corner of Nepperhan and Lake, where he saw two girls in a Ford Galaxy pull into a driveway. Following the girls, intent on them being his victims, he parked the car and ran back to the driveway. But they were gone, unidentified to this day. They themselves probably have no idea how close they came to being the first shooting victims of the Son of Sam. 23 days later, on July 29th, two young ladies wouldn't be so lucky. The preceding day, July 28th, David would repeat the fatal ritual, checking to see the bulldog was loaded, putting it in a paper bag, getting in the car, and heading south. Just after 1 a.m., July 29th, he entered a wide street lined with shops and apartment buildings called Burr Avenue. He exited Burr and circled back. When he returned, he saw two women sitting in a blue Oldsmobile. Quote, I was heading west on Burr Avenue, and I knew I had to get them, and I never saw them until moments before the shooting, end quote. Act 3, Jody Valenti and Donna Loria. Here's our series producer, Allison Baker.
Donna Loria was just 18 years old when she said goodbye to her parents for the last time on the night of June 28, 1976. Donna was a high school graduate who had spent her days working as a medical technician at the Empire State Ambulance Service, and she was the middle child and only daughter of Rose and Michael Loria. On that particular night, the Lorias were gathered together at the Giordano Funeral Parlor, mourning the loss of Donna's uncle Ralph, who had died just 2 days before. After spending the evening with close friends and extended family, Donna's parents Rose and Michael decided to have a late dinner at the chateau, while Donna headed out to meet her best friend, Jody Valenti. Jody, 19 with blonde hair, was a nursing student studying to be an EMT. Donna and Jody weren't just friends, they were also neighbors, and the two had become very close. It was a Wednesday night, but craving some excitement, the two decided to go dancing at a disco in New Rochelle. At the end of the night, the girls climbed into Judy's blue Oldsmobile Cutlass and headed back towards Donna's home at 2860 Buer Avenue, a six-story apartment building in the Bronx. It was near 1 a.m. when they pulled up in front of Donna's place. The girls sat double parked for a moment when they saw two familiar faces approach the car window. It was Donna's parents, who had just returned home from dinner. Donna's father leaned in and told her to say goodbye and come upstairs. Donna, who was mid-conversation with Jody, insisted she would be up in a few minutes after they took the dog out for a walk. Feeling they couldn't convince the teen otherwise, Donna's parents turned and headed into the building, knowing their daughter would be home safe in just a few minutes. It was now 1:10 a.m. As the girls finished their conversation, someone else was coming towards the car, a man in a striped shirt and dark hair. As he approached the car, he lifted his arms straight and with a crumpled paper bag in his hand, unloaded several bullets into the passenger side window. One struck the side of Donna's neck. Another went straight into Jody's thigh. Shots streamed into the car in rapid succession until the gun was empty. Jody looked down and saw blood rushing down her leg. She turned to Donna, now slumped over the steering wheel. Jody began screaming at full volume, pounding her fists on the horn repeatedly as the man with the gun in the bag quickly took off. Donna's father heard the gunshots and came bolting down the stairs. By now, the whole neighborhood had heard the commotion and 911 had been called. An ambulance showed up quickly to take Jody, alive but wounded, to Jacoby Hospital. Donna was bleeding from the neck and unconscious. An EMT tried to revive Donna on the way, but it was too late. She was already dead.
Years later, David recalls the events of that night. Quote, I saw her and another girl sitting in a blue Oldsmobile Cutlass. I parked about two very short blocks away on a side street. I saw both girls sitting there, apparently talking. I circled the car at a distance, like an animal stalking its prey. Cautiously, I was watching for movement from other people in the street. However, there was none. Then, from behind and on the sidewalk, I approached the car, took my revolver out of a paper bag, and stopped parallel to their vehicle. I faced Donna, aimed my gun in the general direction, and fired all five rounds rapidly. I saw the glass breaking into small slivers, the horn started sounding loudly, and then I ran full speed in the direction of my car. I stopped running within 50 feet of the car, then started walking briskly to it. I got in, then drove off. I aroused no attention. I didn't know I had killed her until I read the post the following afternoon. The shooting took place about 1 a.m. End quote. The bullet that killed Donna Loria had left the 3-inch barrel of the Bulldog 44 at a rate of 675 feet per second, smashing through the glass and killing her instantly. David Berkowitz had committed his first murder.
What happened when you actually pulled the trigger, heard shots being fired, heard whatever, screams, shattering glass?
Yeah.
What did you hear? What kind of...
I mean, I hear all those things? Yeah. Well, yes, I did. Not loud screams or anything, but just, you know... I can't. It wasn't very nice. It just didn't even seem real.
He would say later that he felt as though he was in a trance. Question, what kind of feelings did you have? Answer, nothing. Question, nothing? Answer, nothing. Question, you mean that you shot her and killed her in cold blood and you didn't feel anything? Answer, nothing to feel. Question, nothing to feel or fear? Answer, I just saw the glass, thousands of pieces, slow motion. Question, and what happened then? You just stand there? You were, so to say, transfixed? Answer, yes, I emptied the gun and I was still pulling the trigger and it was clicking, but I didn't know it. Then the other girl decided to blow the horn of the car. It shook me up. I found I was still pulling the trigger. Then, when the horns started blowing, I just ran away. I didn't know what else to do. I wasn't sure I shot anybody. You couldn't tell. They just stood there. They didn't move. While shooting these people, I actually became transfixed with the event. The report of the gun, the screams, the shattering of glass and windshields, the blaring horn. It all just possessed my mind so that I'd take notice of nothing else. End quote. Jack asks David what happened next.
Did you run away? Did you?
I ran away.
You didn't catch all the...
No.
How far away did you park your car?
A block and a half away for the first time.
And did you drive immediately back to your car?
Yeah. I just got on my car and casually drove off.
He wanted to get away as quickly as possible and put it out of his mind. And I don't know if he said in so many words that he felt relief, but I sensed that he felt some warped sense of pride. I actually did it. I broke the seal. I made some bones, and he never intended it to be a one-off.
David Berkowitz, who had historically always failed at everything he had ever tried, had carried through to completion the one thing he should have never done. And now, although I think he expected to be, he was not immediately caught. Question, you didn't want to be caught. Answer, that's right. So he went home and he went to sleep. Quote, I went straight home and I went to bed. I got up early the next day to go to work at the cab company in the same neighborhood. I was at work promptly at 6:45 a.m., I made it my point to go to work so I wouldn't arouse any suspicion, but who would have expected me anyhow? I didn't know the victims. That day, I made out better than usual in both tips and fares, end quote.
Did he shake? Did you break down and cry? Did you say, oh my God, what have I done?
Well, at that time, and you have to use tact and caution when you say all this so people understand. At the time, I was so angry that I didn't care. You see, I wasn't sorry for what I did because I felt that they had it coming.
You felt they had it coming.
Yeah.
Quote, after I killed Donna, I felt happy. I felt some peace, sang songs on my way home after killing Donna. That built up tension dissipated temporarily. While I didn't have a physical sexual orgasm, I certainly had a mental one. After a shooting, it was like being in the woods again. I was walking on air. I was literally singing to myself on my way home. After the killing, the tension, the desire to kill a woman had built up in me to such explosive proportions that when I finally pulled the trigger, all the pressures, all the tensions, hatred had just vanished, dissipated, but only for a short time. I had no sexual feelings. It was only hostile aggression. I knew when I did it, it was wrong to do it. I wanted to destroy her because of what she represented. A pretty girl, a threat to me, to my masculinity, and was a child of God, God's creation. I couldn't handle her sexually. I got some revenge. I wasn't bothered by the killing, wasn't haunted by it. I felt powerful and cunning, especially when I put on my innocent look. No one suspected a thing. I knew what I was doing, I knew right from wrong, and I knew that my gun could snuff someone's life. However, I developed such an obsession to do what I did, all the laws or promises of the gas chamber couldn't get me to stop or turn back, end quote. And so, David got in his car and headed back to Yonkers. He did not speed. He was home in a half an hour. Once there, he fell on the bed and into a deep sleep. The next day, he saw a headline on the front of the New York Post, Bronx Girl Slain in Car. It was then he knew he had murdered someone, and that her name was Donna Loria. She would be his first, but unfortunately not his last. Quote, I never thought I killed her. I couldn't believe it. I had the gun in one hand, held the gun in one hand. I just fired the gun, you know, at the car, at the windshield. I never knew she was shot. For people, I no longer had any sympathy whatsoever for anybody. It's very strange. That's what worried me the most. I said, well, I just shot some girl to death, and yet I don't feel, end quote.
For the first murder, he wanted it to be quick. He didn't want the victims to know what was happening. He didn't want to be seen. He fired through the car window. he wasn't a terribly good shot, but he was at such close range that the victim sitting on the side where he fired the weapon died almost instantly from a gunshot wound to the head.
Despite self-reporting that he had been quote-unquote happy with the murder that had made him quote-unquote feel better, David had, in his own way, tried to reach out in the following days.
You never broke down and cried or anything like that?
Yeah, I did.
Were you always alone when you did that, or did you ever...
I know, I did it in front of my cousin one day. Well, it's hard. It's a long story. It's just my a woman cousin, right? She's about 30 years old. And she's close to my father. You know, adoptive, not biological, adoptive. I cried in front of her. I told him the whole world was caving in for some reason. I felt hopelessness that something foreboding was going to happen, something evil. This was just after the first crime, about 2 months after the first crime. I was in her house.
Was that maybe also a way of repenting for the crime?
I know I felt bad about it, although I tried as best as I could to suppress any guilt feelings. I think I was trying to cry out for someone to spot something, you know, ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Pull me out of whatever I was in, but it didn't happen.
First, he broke down to his cousin. Then he tried to confess to his half-sister, Rosalind.
I tried to tell that to my sister, too. I was sitting in a car with her one day, and I wasn't very emotional, though, but I began to tell her that something was happening. That I was like, I said, well, to be vague, you know, but just at the same time to give a hint. I said, well, I'm going on a special mission. I can't tell you what it's about.
On July 31st, just 2 days after he viciously attacked Donna Loria and Jody Valenti, David made a visit to his half-sister Rosalind's house, where he complained of headaches. Like any sane person would, Rosalind urged him to see a doctor. David said he already had, and the doctor had told him that he had a tumor. Quote, I've seen a couple, and they tell me I'm very sick. One of them said I have a brain tumor, end quote. When Rosalind heard this, she was, of course, incredibly concerned and begged him to let her take him to a doctor, but he wouldn't have it. Not long after that interaction, David's adoptive father, Nat, called Rosalind. He was concerned about things David had written him and wanted David to seek immediate psychological care. Nat also told Rosalind about David's headaches, as well as bouts he had witnessed of David hitting himself in the head, and urged her to do what she could to try to get David some help. She said she would. She was unable to. Within a few months, by the fall of 1976, communication between David Berkowitz and his half-sister Rosalind, along with his birth mother Betty, had more or less stopped, and he was no longer visiting either, saying only that he had a new job, which was occupying him most of the time. Rosalind would say later, quote,
when I tried to question him further, he just wouldn't talk. I knew there was something terribly wrong. I could see he was troubled, but he just wouldn't talk about it. I tried to get him to seek help, psychiatric help, but he told me it couldn't help him. He'd said that before. After that day, we didn't see each other again. He called me a few times and also called my mom, but the calls stopped by the end of July. All of us were concerned about David, but none of us ever thought about him being the man who was shooting those young people. It never even crossed my mind.
Betty would say later, quote,
we were sad he wasn't visiting us often, yet glad his new job was going so well. I knew once things became routine at work, he'd come more often.
Of David's last visit, where he spent the night in a bedroom with one of his nieces, Rosalind said, quote,
David had a restless night. He finally got up and raided the refrigerator. He just couldn't sleep. He was like an animal on the prowl. David told me, I'd never hurt you or the girls. I didn't know what he meant.
Quote, Roz's family offered me the comfort of a life I never had. She had two daughters, and her girls were everything to me. Also, there was my mom, my real mother, end quote. Despite these outbursts to family members after the shooting, David Berkowitz said he felt better for a while.
the anger built up to such an explosive point that after like a shooting, it would subside for a period of time, a couple of months, you know. And other, it's all, of course, it's not always the same way. You know, people may just be once. You hear about people that do harm somebody one time or kill somebody one time, and that's it. That released all their pent-up anger, and now they're normal again. In a sense, I know this sounds very, this is very selfish, but in a sense, that's therapy.
According to David, some people only have to kill someone once, but he knew it wasn't going to be like that for him.
After committing the first murder, I don't think he was consciously planning ahead to do other murders, but he knew that he would. He experienced something from reading about the murders the next day in the newspaper, the murder and the maiming of these two women, that there was some sense of gloating, if you can call that a sense of achievement, that he had done it and it was pleasurable in some absolutely twisted way, that it released something inside him that he felt needed to be released and was going to need more attention by claiming the lives of additional victims that he had yet to encounter.
Did you feel the anger subsiding during that process?
It seemed to subside afterwards for a period of a few months or something. You know, it gradually built up again. I had so much anger that one attack against society wasn't going to extinguish it or quench it. It just, you know, would keep on rekindling.
As David's anger was busy rekindling for the next murder, police were none the wiser. When detectives arrived at the Loria Valenti crime scene, they questioned everyone and initially began pursuing a friend of Jody's, as well as Donna's boyfriend, Vinny, as suspects. They also suspected it may have been a mob hit, more specifically, the mob targeting family members of someone they wanted to send a message to, due to the fact that the girls were shot in their car. The police had a few working theories, but unfortunately, none of them were related to David Berkowitz in any way, which meant he was free and clear to strike again. Next time on Killer Tape, David commits his second violent attack with the .44.
The second crime occurred in October of 76. That was in Flushing, Queens, about 1:30 in the morning. I look back at it now and say I'm glad nobody was killed, but at that time I was angry. Because I saw that as a failure, you know. It made me look like a failure that I failed at doing it.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Rosenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt and Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.